prepared to use something else to bend Montenegro to his will. Violence. Pro-Russian politicians had demanded a popular referendum on NATO membership, but Prime Minister Milo Djukanovic replied by stating the obvious. The October election would serve as a referendum. If he and other pro-NATO members won a majority, then ratification would happen. If the opposition won, it wouldn't. On the morning of the election, October 16, Montenegrin authorities arrested 20 Serb nationals who had crossed into Montenegro the night before and charged them with planning a coup d'etat. The Montenegrins were tipped off days before by one of the Serbian coup plotters who had gotten cold feet and defected. According to the subsequent indictment, the plotters planned to stage a protest rally in front of the parliament building on the day of the election. While 50 of them dressed as police stormed the building and killed Montenegrin security police posted there. The protesters would flood into the building and declare a victory for the opposition. A new government would be formed, and Prime Minister Djukanovic would either be arrested or murdered. In the aftermath of the failed plot, two Russian military intelligence agents in Belgrade, who had organized it, made their way back to Moscow after hiring an assassin to kill the Montenegrin prime minister. Initial reports beyond the announced arrests were murky. Government officials were cautious about speaking candidly, especially about Russia's involvement, fearing that they might still be at risk. They accused Russian nationalists of being responsible and eventually arrested two opposition party leaders, but for more than a month they kept mostly quiet about Moscow's responsibility. By the end of November, the New York Times had reported that the failed coup had been conceived and supported by Russia, which the Montenegrin government soon confirmed, eventually issuing indictments for the two absconded Russian intelligence agents. Still, despite the allegations, the initial impression in the West about the bungled affair was that it had been a confused, inept, and probably not very serious threat to the Montenegrin government. I took it seriously, and I thought the most effective way to prevent another attempt was to secure the thing that the coup had been meant to prevent, Montenegro's membership in NATO. I talked to the new Montenegrin prime minister on January 10 and pledged my full commitment to getting the Senate to ratify their accession. The vote had been stalled for months, blocked by two senators, Rand Paul and Mike Lee. Leadership hadn't felt it was urgently necessary to overcome their objections. I tried to convince the Senate it was. Only NATO membership was likely to prevent Russia from other attempts to overthrow the Montenegrin government. I tried to bring ratification up for a vote in early March, and Paul objected, which led to a sharp exchange between us that included my assertion that the Kentucky senator was now working for Vladimir Putin. Senator Paul didn't appreciate that, and I'll grant that it was an intemperate thing to say, but it wasn't incorrect. He might not have worked wittingly for Putin, but he was doing exactly what the Russian one had done. It took a couple of more weeks and a commitment to being a real pain in the ass, badgering leadership and threatening to hold up other business, but we finally cleared the Paul and Lee holds on March 28, and the Senate voted 97-2 to ratify Montenegro's accession. I flew to Montenegro a few days later. I met with the prime minister and with senior officials prosecuting the coup plotters. They read the indictment to me, and it made clear how sophisticated and well-prepared the attempt had been, and how Moscow had masterminded and directed it. It might very well have succeeded had it not been for the one defector who informed on his accomplices. I had the embassy translate the entire 135-page indictment into English and brought it back to Washington, where I shared it with colleagues and reporters. Montenegro officially joined NATO on June 5 and is now protected by the Atlantic Charter's Article 5 that an attack on one member is an attack on us all. I held a committee hearing on July 13, the anniversary of Montenegro's statehood, to examine the details of Russia's involvement, and I invited Montenegro's ambassador to testify. In my opening statement, I explained how nearly successful the coup had been, and I urged NATO to welcome other aspirants and be prepared to resist Putin's covert and overt treachery to prevent it. I warned he would continue his attacks on our democracy and offered suggestions for how to prevent them and take the fight to Putin. Most of all, I urged, we have to stop looking at Russia and its threat to our security and our democracy through the warped lens of politics. We cannot allow Putin to divide us and undermine confidence in ourselves. We must take our own side in this fight, not as Republicans, not as Democrats, but as Americans. Despite the good efforts and good faith of many of my colleagues who have worked to understand the threat and defeat it, we have a way to go before all Americans realize that Putin's goal isn't to defeat a candidate or a party. He means to defeat the West. He will try to interfere, he already is, in our next election, and the election after that, and the election after that. He will keep doing it until we prevent him, and we're behind schedule in that responsibility. I'm sure there are legions of committed national security officials working hard to figure out how to combat his cyber attacks, his disinformation campaigns, and his possible, even likely, effort to hack into our voting machines. But President Trump seems to vary from refusing to believe what Putin is doing to just not caring about it. Just last November, he appeared to take Putin's denials at face value. There's nothing America first, I pointed out, about taking the word of a KGB colonel over that of the American intelligence community. And some House Republicans investigating Russian interference seem more preoccupied with their own conspiracy theories than with a real conspiracy by a foreign enemy to defraud the United States. Unless the elected leaders of our government provide persistent direction and leadership and resources to officials working to defend our democracy, we won't stop Putin's next assault. With a nominal investment of resources and a bold disregard for our resistance, Putin's interference in our last election achieved all his objectives. He damaged Hillary Clinton's campaign, but that wasn't his most important priority. Encouraging our government's dysfunction and disaffection and distrust in the polity were his main objectives. He sees evidence of his success every day in our polarization and gridlock. Just a few weeks before I met with Boris for the last time, President Obama and Putin had spoken on the phone. The very next day, Putin authorized fresh attacks on Ukrainian forces in the Donbas, breaking a ceasefire. He cannot be trusted. He has aided the slaughter of hundreds of thousands of Syrians and made refugees of millions more. He has deliberately and repeatedly bombed hospitals there. He claims he is fighting terrorism, but he isn't. He's fighting freedom. He uses terrorism as an excuse and a method of state power. To his credit, President Trump overturned the Obama policy and supplied lethal assistance to Ukraine, and I commend him for it. But he needs to comprehend the nature of the threat Putin poses. He needs to understand Putin's nature and ours. Last year, he implied that our government was morally equivalent to Putin's regime. We have a lot of killers, too. You think our country is so innocent? He told an interviewer. It was a shameful thing to say, and so unaware of reality. He said it as Vladimir Kara-Murza was near death, as Russian bombs fell on Aleppo hospitals, as Ukrainian soldiers defended their country from another Russian attack, as the most vile false accusations pitting Americans against Americans coursed through social media, disseminated by an army of trolls paid by Vladimir Putin to destroy the fraying bonds established by law and norms that hold our society together. China is our greatest long-term challenge, and one we have yet to concentrate our resources and employ a strategy to counter. Regrettably, our shrewdest response to China's growing influence in the Pacific and challenge to our interests and values, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, was a casualty of the president's campaign demagoguery. The countries we would have partnered with are now negotiating a pact among themselves. The world is learning to live without our active leadership. That's not good for the world, and it won't be good for us. That's the real damage our distractions are doing to our interests, the spurious nationalism animating our politics, our growing distrust of our institutions and of each other, facilitated by the activities of a committed enemy. When President Trump compares us neutrally to the regime of a murderer and thug, it causes our allies and adversaries to wonder, if Americans don't believe in themselves, why should we? China is the challenge of the century. But Putin is the clear and present danger, the immediate threat to America and to the world we have helped make and thrive in. We must fight him as cleverly and as determinedly as he fights us. We will stop him when we stop letting our partisan and personal interests expose our national security interests, even the integrity of our democracy and the rule of law, to his predation. We will stop him when we start believing in ourselves again, in our exceptionalism, and remember that our exceptionalism hasn't anything to do with what we are, prosperous, powerful, envied, but with who we are, people united by ideals, not ethnicity or geography, and how faithfully we stand by those values, not just within our shores, but in the world. We will stop him when we are confident of our strength in the world, not merely the strength of our arms, but the power of our ideals. Government by consent, equal justice, free markets, to continue transforming the world into a broadening civilization that shares them. Americans who demand that we fight globalization are suffering from a kind of anti-historical hysteria. Whose values and interests do they think created the global economy? Ours. We don't have the confidence to compete in a global economy that operates by rules and economic principles that we practically invented? Globalization is a fact, not a policy. It won't disappear because we don't think we're succeeding in it. We can't withdraw from it any more than we can withdraw from the weather. It's where wealth is created, invested, dispersed, exchanged. It will continue making some industries obsolete in the West and propagating new ones. We have to adjust to those dislocations, help those hurt by them, and prepare their children for the opportunities to come. But we thrive in the global economy because we open our markets to other nations and help them thrive and create new markets, new consumers for our goods and services, and importantly, new converts to our way of doing things, to our principles. Open trading relations help make a safer, more stable world, a more prosperous world, a more just world, which is what we did throughout the Cold War and well into this century. We overcame grave threats and huge challenges to do it, and we can overcome Putin's less formidable challenge today. We just have to believe in ourselves and act as responsibly, as exceptionally, as four generations of Americans and 12 presidential administrations, 6 Democratic and 6 Republican, acted as we led the free world. We have to value the world we made and not let someone who fought on the losing side of the struggle for the rules and values that govern it convince us it's not worth fighting for. The Iraq War caused divisions in the West. Some of our closest allies were the most outspoken critics of our decision to invade. None of them more passionately so than Germany's foreign minister at that time, Joschka Fischer. We both attend the Munich Security Conference, where Fischer had famously directly replied to Rumsfeld's WMD justification for the war. "Excuse me, I'm not convinced," he declared. I suspect some of Fischer's irritation had been caused by Rumsfeld's recent grumbling about criticism from old Europe, presumably Germany and France and other Western European countries, and support from New Europe, the nations of the former Warsaw Pact and new NATO members who were more supportive. Fischer and I both spoke sharply about Iraq and Munich, he in heated opposition and I in heated defense. We might have been confused as antagonists, but we were not. We were allies in disagreement, but but allies nevertheless. He was a member of the Green Party in a coalition government with Chancellor Gerhard Schröder's Social Democrats. Schröder would prove in time to be a Putin admirer, or at least a beneficiary of Putin's largesse. He's now on the board of Rosneft. But Fischer wasn't like that despite his party's pacifist philosophy. He is a good man and a committed ally. He supported NATO's intervention in Kosovo and advocated sending German troops to Afghanistan. He asked to see me when he was next in Washington. I assumed he wanted to talk about Iraq, but he didn't, or at least not specifically. He acknowledged our differences on Iraq, but deferred their resolution to the future. History will prove one of us right, he noted with no rancor. What was worrying him most, he said, was the anti-Americanism spreading in Europe that our decision to go into Iraq exacerbated. He had grown up near a U.S. military base. The soldiers had been kind to him and taught him English. Americans were part of Germany, part of Europe. Neither would be the same without the other. He went through this long, lovely recitation of the transatlantic values that united Europe with America and how our relationship ended divisions and rivalries that had roiled the continent for centuries. Twice America had helped end wars Europeans had started, and after the last one, we had promised never to leave. Our presence in Europe, our shared identity as the West, had had a profound effect on generations of Europeans, he said. Our alliance had made Europe better. It was an elegant, compelling appeal for American and European solidarity, and it moved me very much. I had the same fear that we were losing the forest for the trees. The forest was our shared values, our history, the uniqueness of our continuing alliance. I have that same fear now, that we will let the distractions and follies of the moment debilitate our alliance, undermine our solidarity, and leave us vulnerable to the plots of a weak adversary. I addressed that fear last year at the Munich Security Conference. I hope to attend the conference again to see old friends and talk about the future. But if I am unable to, then I am content for my speech from last year's conference to stand as my valedictory address as a proud ally in the world order the West has built. These are dangerous times, but you should not count America out, and we should not count each other out. We must be prudent, but we cannot wring our hands and wallow in self-doubt. We must appreciate the limits of our power, but we cannot allow ourselves to question the rightness and goodness of the West. We must understand and learn from our mistakes, but we cannot be paralyzed by fear. We cannot give up on ourselves and on each other. That is the definition of decadence, and that is how world orders really do decline and fall. This is exactly what our adversaries want. This is their goal. They have no meaningful allies, so they seek to sow dissent among us and divide us from each other. They know that their power and influence are inferior to ours, so they seek to subvert us and erode our resolve to resist and terrorize us into passivity. They know they have little to offer the world beyond selfishness and fear, so they seek to undermine our confidence in ourselves and our belief in our own values. We must take our own side in this fight. We must be vigilant. We must persevere. And through it all, we must never, never cease to believe in the moral superiority of our own values, that we stand for truth against falsehood, freedom against tyranny, right against injustice, hope against despair, and that even though we will inevitably take losses and suffer setbacks, through it all, so long as people of goodwill and courage refuse to lose faith in the West, it will endure. That is why we come to Munich year in and year out to revitalize our common moral purpose, our belief that our values are worth the fighting for. Because in the final analysis, the survival of the West is not just a material struggle. It is now and always has been a moral struggle. Now more than ever, We must not forget this. During one of the darkest years of the early Cold War, William Faulkner delivered a short speech in Stockholm upon receiving the Nobel Prize for Literature. "I decline to accept the end of man," Faulkner said. "I believe that man will not merely endure, he will prevail. He is immortal, not because he alone among creatures has an inexhaustible voice, but because he has a soul, a spirit, capable of compassion and sacrifice and endurance." Even now, when the temptation to despair is greatest, I refuse to accept the end of the West. I refuse to accept the demise of our world order. I refuse to accept that our greatest triumphs cannot once again spring from our moments of greatest peril, as they have so many times before. I refuse to accept that our values are morally equivalent to those of our adversaries. I am a proud, unapologetic believer in the West, and I believe we must always, always stand up for it. For if we do not, who will? Chapter 9, Part of the Main, American Exceptionalism. French writer and aviator Antoine de Saint-Exupéry authored his best-known work, The Little Prince, while living in exile in New York after France's capitulation to Nazi Germany. He returned to the war in the spring of 1943, traveling in an American military convoy to Algiers, where he joined the Free French Air Force fighting with the Allies in North Africa. At 43, he was well past the age limit for pilots, and in pain from permanent injuries suffered in several crashes. At the end of July in 1944, he disappeared without a trace while flying a reconnaissance mission over southern France. His loss was widely mourned. While crossing the Atlantic in the company of American soldiers, Saint-Exupéry was inspired by American idealism and gave testament to it in a letter to an American friend. "If the American soldiers had been sent to war merely in order to protect American interests," he reasoned, "their propaganda would have insisted heavily on your oil wells, your rubber plantations, your threatened commercial markets. But such subjects were hardly mentioned. If war propaganda stressed other things, it was because your soldiers wanted to hear about other things. And what were they told to justify the sacrifice of their lives in their own eyes? They were told of the hostages hanged in Poland, the hostages shot in France. They were told of a new form of slavery that threatened to stifle part of humanity. Propaganda spoke to them not about themselves, but about others. The 50,000 soldiers of this convoy were going to war not for the citizens of the United States, but for man, for human respect, for man's freedom and greatness." Of course, the objects of wars aren't limited to humanitarian causes. Nations fight for their self-interest, their security interests, their economic interests, their cultural interests, all nations, including ours. But what has distinguished us in the great chapters of our history, the attitude that had so impressed Saint-Exupéry, whose observations are displayed today in the D-Day Museum at Utah Beach, is that we have seen our interest in the world as inextricably linked to the global progress of our ideals. I believe the United States has a special responsibility to champion human rights in all places, for all peoples, and at all times. I believe that all my life. I was raised to believe it, to see in the example of gallantry put before me in the histories and novels and poems I was encouraged to read, in the conduct of the heroes I admired, those to whom I was related or knew personally, and those who were commended to me. I am a democratic internationalist, a proud one, and have been all my public life. I could have been nothing else given my role models and influences. I took from Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls that defending the dignity of others is never a lost cause, whether you succeed or not. And I thrilled to the exhortation in the poem that inspired the novel to be part of the main, to be involved in mankind. It's who we are, the right to life and liberty, to be governed by consent and ruled by laws, to have equal justice and protection of property. These values are the core of our national identity, and it is fidelity to them, not ethnicity or religion, culture or class, that makes one an American. To accept the abolition or abridgment of those rights in other societies should be no less false to Americans than their abridgment in our own society. Human rights are not our invention. They don't represent standards from which particular cultures or religions can be exempted. They are universal. They exist above the state and beyond history. They cannot be rescinded by one government any more than they can be granted by another. That's our creed. The authors put it right at the beginning of the manifesto they wrote to declare our independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. That creed gave us a purpose in the world greater than self-interest, a cause that encompasses our interest, but is not defined by us alone. As Harry Truman once said of America, God has created us and brought us to our present position of power and strength for some great purpose. Where rulers abused their people, we spoke up, we protested, we drew attention, we identified with the abused and demanded better from the abuser. We used diplomatic and economic pressure to protect dissidents, to free political prisoners, to restrain autocrats, to get them to stop resisting change or at least modify their behavior enough to let change eventually undo them. Human rights advocacy isn't naive idealism. It's the truest kind of realism. Statesmen who think that all that really matters in international relations is how governments treat each other are wrong. The character of states can't be separated from their conduct in the world. Governments that protect the rights of their citizens are more likely to play a peaceful, constructive role in world affairs. Governments that are unjust, that cheat, lie, steal, and use violence against their own people are more likely to do the same to other nations. Take Russia, for example. It's not a coincidence that as the Kremlin has reverted to autocracy at home under its crooked ex-KGB Colonel Vladimir Putin, it has become ever more aggressive abroad, occupying territories that belong to its neighbors, helping one of the cruelest regimes on earth, Bashar Assad's, slaughter hundreds of thousands of Syrians, interfering in an American presidential election with the intention of helping elect the candidate they believed would pose the least resistance to their ambitions. Not even that last offense is entirely surprising considering the character of revanchist Russia and its vain and corrupt leader who decried the collapse of the Soviet Union and its evil empire. Why? Because of all the good the Soviets did in the world? They were the Eastern Front against Nazi Germany. That is their only welcome political or military contribution to history. The rest is a saga of corruption, brute force, and atrocious inhumanity followed by decay and collapse. If we don't accept that the nature of a regime shapes their conduct, we risk profoundly misreading international politics. We expect better behavior from despots than we have reason to. We miss what can be the most transformational force for good in the world, the anger of oppressed people and their hope, their imperishable hope for change. That anger and hope filled the streets of East Berlin 29 years ago, tore down a wall separating half a continent from liberty, and made the United States and our allies a whole lot safer. A world where the human rights of more people in more places are secure is not only a more just world, it's a safer world. For reasons of basic self-interest, we must continue to lead the long, patient effort to make the world freer and more just. I consider myself a realist. I have certainly seen my share of the world as it really is, and not how I wish it would be. What I've learned is that it is foolish to view realism and idealism as incompatible, or to consider our power and wealth as encumbered by the demands of justice, morality, and conscience. In the real world, as lived and experienced by real people, the demand for human rights and dignity, the longing for liberty and justice and opportunity, the hatred of oppression and corruption and cruelty is reality. By denying this experience, we deny the aspirations of billions of people and invite their enduring resentment. The benefits of promoting our values can be a long time coming. The rights of others will never be our only priority, but they must always be a high priority. Our interests will often necessitate dealing with some pretty bad actors, but we shouldn't pay for the privilege by declining to criticize how they mistreat their people. We should demonstrate to the oppressed that as we negotiate with their oppressors, we haven't forsaken them. We are still on their side. Ronald Reagan negotiated with the Soviets when he believed it was in our security interest to do so. And while he did so, he routinely reminded them they were on the wrong side of history. He told Mikhail Gorbachev what he should do with his wall. He used engagement with our adversary as an opportunity to, among other things, demand better treatment for the captive peoples of the evil empire. And when he tempered his public criticisms of Soviet behavior, it was in response to real progress on their part, not in exchange for engagement itself. My youngest children have only read about the Berlin Wall. Their world was never divided by it. Their lives weren't affected by its shadow. But for those of us born before or during the Cold War, that blessing was the achievement of a long twilight struggle. I remember the enormous sacrifice it entailed, the many brave souls, some of them my friends, who gave their lives to secure it. I remember a span of half a century when, for all our differences, Americans maintained a bipartisan commitment to the freedom and security of our allies. And together, we kept faith with those on the other side of the walls that divided the free and the oppressed. We were confident they wanted the same things we did: freedom, equal justice, the rule of law, a fair chance to prosper by their own industry and talents. We kept the faith, and we prevailed. No one of my acquaintance ever believed in that faith more sincerely, more ardently, than Henry Scoop Jackson, U.S. Senator from the state of Washington, and in his time, the Senate's great apostle of freedom. I knew him when I was the Navy's liaison to the Senate and escorted him on some of his many travels abroad. He was a champion for the world's oppressed and an enemy to those who gained power for themselves by disregarding the humanity of others. He was a classic Cold War liberal, anti-communist to the bone. He complicated the Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger policy of detente with the Soviets by insisting it not come at the expense of America's commitment to human rights. Over their objections, he passed legislation that conditioned trade with the Soviets and other autocratic regimes on the relaxation of emigration policies. He was a hero to Soviet Jews wishing to emigrate to Israel. I once escorted a large Senate delegation on a trip to Israel. The delegation included many strong supporters of the Jewish state, but only one man among them was greeted with the ecstatic approval more typical of a pop star's welcome. As the delegation's bus passed through the gates of Tel Aviv Airport, a crowd of nearly 1,000, mostly former refuseniks and their families, had gathered to shout their gratitude and admiration for Scoop Jackson. They mobbed us, slowing the bus's progress to a crawl. Scoop and his beloved wife, Helen, were genuinely moved by the outpouring of affection. So was I, recognizing it, as Scoop surely did, as an outpouring of affection for America and our ideals. We don't always appreciate, as we should, the values others place on the public statements of American officials. It matters what we say and what we don't say. The U.S. remains the world's leading power, and when our leaders speak, governments and people take notice. Natan Sharansky told me how word of Reagan's statements on their behalf reached him and his fellow dissidents in prison and sustained them, knowing they were not forgotten by the world's greatest power and most idealistic nation. Reagan's famous speech to the British Parliament in 1982 that envisioned the West's approaching victory in the Cold War and committed America to vigorous support for democratic movements the world over inspired the men and women who persevere through threats and setbacks to claim for their nations the universal values that bind ours. And the products of his Westminster speech, the National Endowment for Democracy, and its affiliated organizations, including the International Republican Institute, have given support and advice to many of those movements. Our public support for the oppressed and criticism of their oppressors can affect change. I speak from personal experience. After America and the world learned that the POWs in North Vietnam were being mistreated, Hanoi was stunned by the criticism they received even from anti-war voices in the U.S. and in the capitals of other countries that opposed America's intervention, and our treatment improved. Often the very act of supporting human rights overseas compels us to make our own shining city upon a hill worthier of such a boast. There's a story about Vice President Richard Nixon visiting the West African country of Ghana in 1957 to mark its official independence from the British Empire. Moved by the jubilant celebration, Nixon is reported to have asked one ecstatic Ghanaian after another, "How does it feel to be free?" Until one young man replied, "I wouldn't know, sir. I'm from Alabama." Our support during the Cold War for the human rights of the peoples of the Soviet Union and its satellites helped force us to face up to our own failings more honestly. Russians, Cubans, Vietnamese, and just about every Marxist-Leninist regime in the world responded to our criticism of them with reminders that we continued to deny full citizenship to African Americans. Exposing our hypocrisy to the world played a part in forcing change in America, helping convince leaders to adopt laws that oblige us to live up to our values. The Voting Rights Act in 1965 and the Detainee Treatment Act 40 years later were to an extent a response to accusations that our proselytizing on behalf of the God-given dignity of all people was cynical. Most important of all, America's support, rhetorical and material, for the advance of freedom and justice to all peoples everywhere is sometimes the only expression of international solidarity that is known to the world's worst oppressed, the jailed and tortured and murdered, the only glimpse of hope in their despair, the only evidence they are not forsaken. I traveled with a Senate delegation to Burma in January 2012. It was my second trip there in 4 months. The long-suffering Burmese people were on the cusp of real progress. The military junta that had misruled, mistreated, murdered, and imprisoned them had given way in 2011 to an elected government of mostly ex-military officers, not fairly elected, to be sure, but a government that appeared to recognize the need for political reform. Any sign of an opening in Burma, renamed Myanmar by the junta, was encouraging, considering the many atrocities committed by the regime, from child conscripts to ethnic cleansing. Regime officials had opened talks with the last fairly elected leader of the country, Aung San Suu Kyi, whom I had met on my first trip to Burma in the 1990s and who was a personal hero to me. Those talks led to genuine political reforms and a promise of parliamentary elections in April 2012 that Suu Kyi's party, the National League for Democracy, would win. I had gone to Burma in September 2011 to encourage the progress that had begun, to urge the release of all political prisoners, and to meet for the first time in 15 years the woman I so admired. I came back the following January with friends Joe Lieberman, New Hampshire Senator Kelly Ayotte, and Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, after hundreds of prisoners had been released. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had come the month before, the most senior U.S. official to visit the country in more than half a century. We were there to reinforce that a better relationship with the U.S. was within prospect, including the lifting of economic sanctions we had imposed on Burma, were the April elections, as promised, free and fair. We reminded our hosts that the Obama administration and Congress would be guided in those decisions by Suu Kyi's views. It was a brief visit and a crowded schedule, but I'll remember one of our meetings for as long as I live. Full diplomatic relations between our two countries had yet to be reestablished, so we didn't have an ambassador in Burma. A chargé d'affaires led our country team there, and the meeting was held at his residence. The men we had come to meet, all in their 50s, were leaders of the 88 Generation, an organization of Burmese democratic activists that take its name from the student protests in 1988 that culminated in a general strike and ultimately in Suu Kyi's election in 1990. The men had been active in the protests, which had been suppressed with terrible bloodshed, and were arrested in the ensuing crackdown. They formed the 88 Generation in 2005 and played a critical role in organizing massive protests against the regime in 2007, when hundreds of thousands of Burmese, led by Buddhist monks, took to the streets of Rangoon. The Saffron Revolution was the largest political demonstration since the 1988 uprising. Minko Nine was sentenced to 20 years, imprisonment in 1988. Tortured, his health wrecked, and his case championed by Amnesty International and other human rights organizations, he was released after 15 years in 2004. He was rearrested in September and imprisoned for several months. No charges were filed and no reason given for his release, shortly after which he helped found Generation 88. He was arrested again in August 2007 for his role in the Saffron Revolution and sentenced with other 88 Generation leaders to 65 years in a remote prison where he was held in solitary confinement. Koko G had been arrested and held briefly in 1989, then rearrested in 1991. He was released in 2005, arrested in the same crackdown that claimed Minko Nine. Like Min, he was released without explanation in January 2007. With Min, he was arrested again during the Saffron Revolution and sentenced to 65 years in the same remote prison. Tay Chwe was arrested in 1991 and released in 2004, rounded up with Min and Ko in September 2005. Although he managed to evade capture a couple of months longer than Min and Ko, he was again arrested in 2007, tried and sentenced to 65 years hard labor in another remote prison. All three men had been released from prison in a general amnesty 10 days before our meeting. Each had spent cumulatively more than 20 years in prison. All had been tortured, held in solitary confinement for long periods, and had suffered from poor conditions and malnourishment. Their cases had been publicized by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and various other human rights organizations, as well as by the State Department and American politicians from both parties. I had been vocal about Burma since my first visit, had sponsored legislation sanctioning the regime, and had regularly made statements, signed letters, and given interviews on behalf of Suu Kyi and the 88 Generation prisoners, including the suffering souls I met that day. They had heard and seen all of it, all the advocacy in the West for their cause and for them personally. It had helped sustain them in dark hours. These simple, easily made gestures of solidarity had meant everything to them, and they were emotional when we were introduced. One wept when I started to speak. My disembodied voice had become familiar to him from Voice of America and Radio Free Asia broadcasts. They embraced me over and over again and thanked me profusely as if I had saved their lives when all I had done was mention their names every now and again. It was one of the most touching encounters of my life. There's nothing so rewarding as contributing, even if only in the most modest way, to the defense of another human being's dignity, all the more so when the person is otherwise a stranger to you. God bless the people who devote themselves to the liberation of the oppressed, to the spread of democracy and the rule of law in countries that are not their own, particularly those who do so at the risk of their own lives. Their example instructs us to speak up for our values and for people denied them wherever they are. Sometimes that's harder to do than on other occasions. Sometimes we have security interests at stake that loom larger in our list of priorities than the rights denied citizens in the country concerned, in Saudi Arabia, for example, with whom we have enemies in common. Sometimes the criticism falls on friends with whom we have more than just common enemies, but common values and shared causes. I have admired few public figures more than I admire Aung San Suu Kyi. I have spoken and written of my admiration for her many times, and yet if we are truly committed to the progress of democracy and justice in Burma, she must be held to higher standards than we expected from the regime that held her in house arrest for so many years. The atrocities perpetrated against Rohingya Muslims in the northern Burmese province of Rakhine by the Burmese military and allegedly by Buddhist monks in the world's latest episode of ethnic cleansing should be condemned by every decent person with knowledge of them. That surely includes the recognized leader of Burma's Democrats. Many thousands have been killed, 500,000 have fled the country and are homeless. Tales of their suffering are rife with accounts of rape and the most extreme physical abuse and cruelty. Yet Aung San Suu Kyi, who gave up her freedom, her family, her comfortable life in the West to help free her native country from tyranny, has been mostly silent about the inhumane treatment of the Rohingya. Political change in Burma is delicate and reversible. She has to be careful not to alienate the military, which allows her and her fellow Democrats to govern and to move the country slowly toward a time when political reforms are firmly rooted. But that caution must not demand that a voice as important as hers be stilled when confronted with human rights abuses on a grand scale. Nor can ours be quiet out of respect for her. The rights of the Rohingya are as sacred as the rights of the 88 generation. They too deserve to hear voices raised in their defense in the leading democracies of the world. They too deserve our respect for their dignity and our condemnation of those who oppress them. It's as wrong to refuse them our support as it would have been to refuse it to Suu Kyi, to the 88 generation activists, to the Buddhist monks in the Saffron Revolution. Yes, we often have important interests involved in relations with dictatorial regimes that those regimes will try to leverage to get us to turn a blind eye to corruption and human rights abuses. We can't let them. We have to trust that whatever interest the regime has in a relationship with us is more than a desire to buy our silence. Since 2001, we had relied on an airbase in southeastern Uzbekistan, Karshikanabad, or K2, to fly reconnaissance and air logistic missions, and to stage special forces operations. It was an important asset in our fight against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Islam Karimov was elected the first president of Uzbekistan in 1991 after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Once elected, he showed little interest in leaving to Uzbeks the decision of whether he continued in office. He was a former party apparatchik and a thug. He arrested opponents and put down protests with force. In 2005, his security forces fired into a crowd of protesters in the city of Andijan, killing more than 1,000. Many of the victims were buried in secret mass graves, but word about the atrocity spread to the West. As it happened, I was planning a trip to the region around the same time with Joe Lieberman, Lindsey Graham, and New Hampshire Senator John Sununu. We were going to visit Uzbekistan's neighbor, Kyrgyzstan, which had just had a color revolution of its own, the Tulip Revolution, and a new government had taken office. We were going to overfly Uzbekistan to get there. Having learned of the Andijan massacre, we decided to apply for visas and ask for a meeting with Uzbek officials to impress on them that Congress plays a role in making foreign policy, and we could use our influence to deny Uzbekistan some of the benefits of a relationship with the U.S. We were granted the visas but refused meetings with the government. Fine, we thought. We would still fly in, hold a press conference to protest the regime's abuses, demand an international investigation of the massacre, and fly right back out before the government could react. I didn't know much more about Uzbekistan. I had a vague, romantic notion of one of its cities, Samarkand, which I had always wanted to visit. It was on the Silk Road and featured in the title of a poem I had memorized as a child, The Golden Road to Samarkand, by James Elroy Flecker. For lust of knowing what should not be known, we take the golden road to Samarkand. But there would be no Samarkand visit on this trip, nor ever, I regret to say. Just a ride from the airport in Tashkent, the capital, through its deserted, dreary streets in the shadow of Soviet-style cement apartment slabs, to the U.S. Embassy, which, if memory serves, was a converted discotheque with office cubicles and a dim lighting system. There we met with a few representatives of the opposition, who seemed beleaguered but brave. Our ambassador at the time, John Purnell, was a talented professional, knowledgeable, self-assured, straightforward. He knew we understood the importance of retaining access to K2, but he knew, too, that we have a moral obligation to condemn atrocities and hold the guilty parties accountable. Turning a blind eye encourages more Andijans. We held our press conference, each of us condemning the regime in lacerating language, calling for an independent investigation and adjudication, and warning that our relationship, airfield or no airfield, couldn't continue if the regime were to commit crimes against humanity. The ambassador, who betrayed little visible discomfort at our stridency, although he wouldn't have been the intelligent diplomat he was had he not cringed a little, dutifully seconded our sentiments nevertheless. Then we loaded in embassy cars and returned to the airport, as relieved to get out of the place as I imagine Ambassador Purnell was to see us go. We hadn't been in the country much more than 2 hours. Unfortunately, moments after our military aircraft had taken off, we'd had a bird strike. Blood was all over one of the engines. We had to return to the airport. 1950s-era fire trucks raced out on the tarmac to meet us. A woman carrying an old black medical bag, a doctor, I assumed, ascended the mobile staircase to treat the wounded. Fortunately, we didn't have any. The pilots wanted maintenance engineers to check that no serious damage had been done to the engine, and assuming there wasn't any, we would be shortly underway again. But an official from the Uzbek Aviation Authority informed us that we would have to file a new flight plan with her office, which was closed for the day. "What do you mean?" we asked. "You cannot leave today," came the answer. We assumed we were being subjected to an old Soviet form of bureaucratic abuse for foreign visitors who insulted the authorities. What other inconveniences might we suffer while spending an unscheduled night in Tashkent? The pilots pled our case to no avail. Purnell, who had left the airport, was summoned back. He was all business. He told us to remain on the plane while he negotiated our release. He started firing questions at the official. "Who do we have to file a flight plan with? Are they really closed? Who would we file with in an emergency?" For 2 hours he negotiated on our behalf until his wearied interlocutor relented and let us go. We weren't the only people to condemn the Karimov regime. Most of the West did, including the United States government, and as feared, Karimov reacted to the international denunciations by ordering the U.S. to vacate Karshi Khanabad. But if the price for using the base was to ignore an atrocity of the magnitude of Andijan, which would signal to tyrants elsewhere that American values were transactional, then we were better off making other arrangements. Scoop Jackson's opposition to Soviet tyranny and aggression, and his support for the world's oppressed, made him as much of an irritant to Jimmy Carter's administration as he had been to the governments of Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford. Scoop had his convictions. He believed in America's mission, and when it came to acting on his beliefs, he didn't particularly give a damn which party was in power. America's ideals came before party loyalty for him. I've had disagreements with every presidential administration in office during the years I've served in Congress, even on occasion with the policies of President Reagan, a president I revered. I voted to override his veto of sanctions against South Africa's apartheid government, and I opposed his deployment of Marines to Beirut. I had had more numerous and stronger objections with the policies of other administrations, but it's fair to say that I've disagreed sometimes too heatedly and sometimes unfairly with all of them. That's partly because of my nature. I can be as happy in opposition to government as I am in cooperating with it, sometimes happier. I like to fight, and I like people who like to fight, even if they're fighting with me, especially when the cause is worth fighting about. There was much I admired about George W. Bush's focus on democratic internationalism and his defense of oppressed peoples. But I argued strenuously against his government's treatment of captured enemies because it violated the ideals he wanted to advance in the world. I didn't think the Obama administration paid sufficient attention to human rights concerns, and its support for democratic movements in closed societies was too subordinate to other priorities. I've been accused of being too quick to propose that the U.S. intervene militarily in other countries' civil strife in support of embattled democratic movements. I have suggested on a few occasions limited U.S. military support for freedom fighters in civil wars that threaten vital U.S. security interests, or where the regime is committed or is about to commit monstrous atrocities. I support using U.S. air power to create safe zones in Syria, and I advocated using NATO air power to prevent Muammar Gaddafi from slaughtering tens of thousands of Libyan rebels. More often, I've proposed providing material support, including, where appropriate, weapons to those fighting to liberate their country from violent oppression or foreign domination. Most often, all I've called for is that the government of the world's leading democracy in its relations with oppressive regimes speak loudly, persistently, and unambiguously in support of the brave souls who protest them. Iran's Green Movement began in reaction to the fraudulent re-election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad over the reformer Mir Hossein Mousavi in June 2009. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Iranians, impatient for social change and international acceptance, poured into the streets of Tehran. The United States should have been on their side from the beginning, giving them public support, lending credence to their protest that the election had been stolen, and encouraging our allies to do the same. We might have offered the kinds of clandestine communications, financial and other non-lethal support that we have provided other democratic movements. But barring riskier policies like that, we should have at least been full-throated in our support of the protests. Yet President Obama seemed reluctant from the outset to offer more than perfunctory rhetorical support for the protesters, never once to my recollection endorsing their principal demand, a fair election. He wanted to cultivate a better relationship with the Iranian regime than had existed since the Islamic Revolution of 1979, to, I assume, bring it into the world community with a goal of moderating its behavior and securing an agreement to suspend its nuclear weapons program. Perhaps the administration didn't believe the protests could succeed and didn't want to jeopardize other interests by vigorously defending them. But the idea that you could make any real progress towards integrating Iran into the international system and negotiating a nuclear deal while the virulent anti-American Holocaust-denying Ahmadinejad was in office seems to me considerably more naive than to believe the Green Movement protesters could have forced real change in Iran. I didn't expect the president to abandon his other priorities in Iran or even to threaten the regime. I did want him to protest vociferously its anti-democratic nature and its inhumanity and call on the world community to do likewise. I wanted him to identify unmistakably